Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. The 70,000-square-foot Rubin Museum of Art in Manhattan's Chelsea neighborhood opened in 2004. It originated from the private collection of Himalayan art that Donald and Shelley Rubin had been collecting for 60 years. Included in the 1,000 objects are paintings, sculptures, textiles, and ritual objects that span the 2nd to the 20th centuries. Dawn Eshelman, my guest today, is the head of programs for the Rubin. In that capacity, she creates interactive programs that explore overarching ideas in art from the Himalayan region. They include lectures, film screenings, live music, dance, demonstrations, and, believe it or not, sleepovers. It's Dawn who came up with the Rubin Museum's Dreamover program. Dawn has a Bachelor of Arts from UC Santa Cruz and a Master's in Leadership and Museum Education from Manhattan's Bank Street College, where she is a guest lecturer. Dawn, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Sandy.
So a Master's in Leadership and Museum Education, what exactly is that?
It's a very specialized degree, isn't it? It is from the wonderful Bank Street College of Education here in New York, which really prioritizes experiential education. So one way to describe what I do is adult education. I really focus on adult audiences. And so through this program at Bank Street, I was able to really articulate and formalize a lot of the theories, educational theories and approaches that I use in my own work at the museum.
Where did that come from? Meaning, did you always want to be around art? Was it a no-brainer for you to pursue this career?
No, I really stumbled into this.
I hear that a lot from the women I interview.
And gratefully so. My background is in theater and dance.
Well, that on some level makes sense in terms of the interactive programs.
Sure.
So you wanted to be a performer.
Yes, and I was a performer for many years, and that's what brought me to New York. I'm from California, from the Bay Area.
Ah, yes. Okay. So you went all, one coast to the other.
I did, yes.
Usually it's the other way around.
Right? Yeah, that's true.
We come to you.
So I had a really interesting trajectory in my career because as I performed, I also began to work administratively in producing performance and did that for many years in Seattle, where I went first after California.
So was this live theater? Was it dance?
Experimental performance and contemporary performance. So live theater, for sure, dance. I worked for an organization called On the Boards in Seattle, which is the Northwest's premier contemporary arts center. And then I came to New York, and I worked with a dance theater workshop, and also in Chelsea, the Rubin's neighbor, in fact.
And the Rubin's neighbor is also the Joyce Theater.
Joyce Theater, that's right. I helped produce many Bessie's Award ceremonies there at the Joyce through my work at Dance Theater Workshop. And also just ancillary performances and fun, interesting kind of downtown theater experiences.
So kind of eclectic.
Absolutely. And that's brought me to Japan Society, where I worked in the performing arts program there, helping to present artists from Japan, and our department helped them tour all around the U.S. We have a gallery at Japan Society as well, and so that was kind of my crossover organization from focusing on artists and performing artists to really this landscape of the museum and what that had to offer. And that's how I came to the Rubin Museum. There was really an interesting transition for me there from this artist-focused work to what I would call, and the field calls, visitor-focused work. Mm. So as an artist myself, I kind of came to see the audience as taking this role of the performer in a way and being curious about how I could work with them in interactive ways to really empower them to be kind of decision makers in their own experiences.
I need you to explain that a little bit more in depth. Use me as a for instance.
So in my work with performing arts organizations that, you know, are really artist focused, we would work on supporting an artist to develop and really helping them come to the fullest fruition of their expression that they could. Visitor centers organization focus on the public and focus on the experience of the public. And so I was really interested in kind of marrying those experiences. So what is the kind of artistic expression of being a museum visitor? How is that a creative endeavor? When you go to a museum, you feel creative, right?
That's a really interesting question, and I think it's very nuanced. I certainly am extremely appreciative of what I see. Sometimes I'm confused and not sure. I look at the art that's on the wall, and I just take it from there. And more than that, I guess I never really thought about it.
Mm-hmm. That's, I guess, where my job comes in.
I think so. Yes. You have to share with me that this is not just the only way to experience
that's
art.
That's right. So I'll give you an example
sure.
of a program that mm-hmm. you mentioned in the intro, the Dreamover, right? So this is a sleepover for grownups in our galleries.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I should contextualize this by just telling you a little bit more about the Rubin.
For sure, yes.
So the Rubin Museum of Art, we are all about the human experience and really understanding what it means to be human. In this day and age, through the lens of the art in our collection, and that is art from Tibet, Nepal, Bhutan, China, India, Mongolia, and other countries in the Himalayan region.
And that was the goal from the get-go?
That's right. Yeah.
That's what the Rubens wanted to achieve.
The vision of the Rubens. Mm-hmm. That's right. And in addition to exploring the living traditions of those cultures, we also put a spotlight on kind of the universality of some of these concepts like compassion, transformation, what it means to face your fears, and even things like happiness.
Sure.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Bhutan is known as the world's happiest place, where they actually measure their kind of happiness per capita and do studies through the UN mm-hmm. about this, right? So we explore those concepts and what they mean through a lot of different perspectives. So, for example, let's take happiness. We did an entire series of talks on happiness and what that means. And we decided to invite the grumpiest people that we could find.
And who were they?
To come and talk about that. So that's how Elaine Stritch ended up on stage at the Rubin Museum of Art. And of course, she's hilarious and certainly not just grumpy, but
kind of a curmudgeon.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And we even had the pleasure of speaking with Philip Seymour Hoffman about
before he died.
Yeah, his perspective on mm-hmm. happiness. So just some different ways in to these concepts that really relate to all of us.
Did that not happen at the Rubin before you got there?
No, I work on a team of people, of very creative people. And so I would say none of the work that I do is without that group of people. And
so I'm just asking if you were the catalyst for this.
No, I would say that it really is a team effort. And I can tell you a little bit about the Dreamover project.
Oh, I'd love to hear about it, for sure.
That might shed a little light on kind of how I work and my creative process.
Mm-hmm.
The Dreamover is a sleepover in our galleries for grownups. We ask participants to fill out a questionnaire in advance. And based on their answers to three questions, we pair them with an artwork that they then sleep under.
Oh, wow.
So it's like a blind date with a work of art.
Yeah, it sure is.
And it gets
Would
to the
Would you share
heart.
The questions?
Of course, yes. The questions are, why are you here at this event? What has brought you here? What are the three most important things that have happened to you in your life? And what color do you resonate with most strongly? And then based on those answers, we select an artwork for people to sleep and dream under.
Whoa.
It's just theirs for the night. And
wow.
The idea is to really get people to spend a long time with one artwork. You know, we all go through museums and there is such a thing as museum fatigue, right?
Oh, yeah. Overload.
Yes. And you want to see everything. So you kind of just stop and take a peek at one thing. But this was a way of really trying to support people to authentically want to spend time with one artwork over the course of a whole night. And not only to look at it, but to ask it to really enter your subconscious,
mm-hmm.
see what it has to say to you. So part of what we do at the Rubin Museum is to help create personal connections between people and art. So this kind of personalization trick
mm-hmm.
helps that. And, you know, really asking people who they are from the get-go and not just, you know, the surface questions, but really tell us in this kind of almost haiku format, what is important to you?
How many people do this on an average
We have generally about 90 dreamers.
Who spend the night? 90?
Yeah. We take over. We take over the museum for a night.
Well, you are six floors.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I might be sleeping with a work of art with a complete stranger.
You know, I think it's a really interesting experience to, you know, snore next to someone you've never met before. but also to really have this very personal experience and to get to share that with a group of people. So because the 90 dreamers are divided on those six floors, they have kind of a core group of maybe 20 people, mm-hmm. right, per floor.
Per floor, yeah.
It's kind of like a camp cabin. That's how I like to refer to it. And so people get really tight, even after just a night. And one thing I should mention is that it takes about half as many volunteers to put this program on as it does, you know, for the dreamer. So we have about 50 volunteers. We have a team of docents who really host this event and take people individually, one-on-one, to meet their artwork. They'll say, Sandy, you have been paired with Green Tara. And Green Tara is known for her compassion. And she, you can see from her posture here that her foot is poking out a little bit from her seated position. And that means that she's ready to jump out and help you with whatever it is you need help with tonight.
Wow.
So we'll talk through a little bit of the visual symbolism mm-hmm. And unpack that, because Himalayan art is rich and very dense with this symbolism. And
well, it becomes a religious experience.
Well, I think that depends on the visitor and mm-hmm. what they want out of the experience. I think for some, it can be. And certainly, much of this art is created through religious tradition. I think a lot of the art in our collection is based in Tibetan Buddhism.
Right, right.
So it certainly was made for that.
Right.
But really, that's up to the interest level of the person who is there. And I think that is one of the things that we found to be successful about this particular program is the kind of the multiple entry points that people can have. So we'll have folks come to this program that are Buddhist practitioners, that maybe grew up in the area, in the Himalayan region, or, you know, have some kind of connection to it otherwise. And then we'll just have people who have never been to the Rubin Museum before at all. They just want to spend the night.
And whose interest was piqued by this kind of unorthodox way of getting involved with art.
That's right. They just want to spend the night in a museum. They want to be surrounded by these objects, and they want to be in this, you know, this special place, this kind of liminal place.
Well, not for nothing, Dawn, you gave new meaning to the movie and the night in the museum. Tell me how you came up with this, or was it just simply a no-brainer for you?
We offered a program for kids. It was not the same experience of sleeping in the galleries, but it was an overnight. It was called Peak Experience. My brilliant colleague Tim McHenry came up with this idea. Peak Experience refers to a mountain climb. Basically, when you get to the top of the mountain, you have a peak experience. And so this was a simulated kind of mountain climb, which is really super fun, using the museum's six floors as this experience of the mountain, metaphorically.
Well, as you're climbing that spiral staircase.
That's right.
Which is exhilarating and exciting, and I think also a bit overwhelming, because it's so, to look at it. And
yes, and to look down from the top.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
But the kids would all sleep in the cafe, which we, of course, transformed into base camp. But, you know, as part of really my studies at Bank Street and really exploring this idea of experiential education, really what it means to have an experience and make something very personal to you, to learn deeply about it. You know, I'm really passionate about adult education, and I think that adults are ready for meaningful adventure just as much as kids are.
Not having the same old, same old.
Yeah.
But in that same breath, was there concern about making sure that people would come to the Rubin and come to the Rubin again, not only to your museum? Is there not a concern by these wonderful art institutions that we're not getting people?
Oh, of course.
And that if you are coming, we really want you to come back.
Oh, I think it's an issue around arts and culture in general right now. For the museum field, of course it is. And I think it is a really interesting time to be in the field right now, because—
Is that a diplomatic word? Interesting?
No, I really appreciate it. I appreciate this moment very much because the museum field is shifting from being about objects, mm-hmm. I think.
To now being user-friendly.
Being about more, people.
More user-friendly, yeah. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. To being about people. And, you know, this is all speaking to me strongly from my background in theater and dance. And really, I mean, the Dreamover is just a big play with the audience as the actors. So I think, you know, just finding opportunities to push that edge is something that I really enjoy and is really fulfilling for me about my job is where can I make space for the visitor? How can they participate? You know, what's a new and interesting way that they can really take on this role of making meaning in their own lives instead of the institution telling you what something means?
Right. How many Dreamovers do you tend to do a year?
We do one a year. And I should add that there's another team of people, volunteers, that contribute to this. This is a group of usually psychology students that come in, and they lead a conversation in the evening mm-hmm. and one in the morning. One is to prepare for dreams and to talk about, you know, with these kind of small groups, the kind of cabins, about how they feel about approaching this together, and then what happens in the morning to kind of break it down. And then one really important perspective is that of a Tibetan Lama. So we do bring in a Tibetan Lama, usually our friend Lama Pema, and a psychologist to have a conversation on stage from the perspective of Tibetan Buddhism and also Western psychology about what dreams are, what they mean, and how we can use them in our lives.
Would you like to expand it to include more than one night a year?
Of course, I want people to be able to access it, and it sells out in a day, so that is a challenge.
Is it free?
I think our recent price is $108, so cheaper than a hotel, mm-hmm, you know?
Mm-hmm. Certainly a hotel in Manhattan. Uh-huh.
But a really rich experience. I don't necessarily want to do it more than once for any other reason than just to make it more accessible. I like to be able to offer special experiences. I think it's intuitive and there's something alchemical about it. And so I don't really want to make it into a kind of machine that runs all the time.
What are some of the other things you've worked on that are unusual?
So it's becoming a little more popular these days and something that might not seem so unusual for a museum of Himalayan art, but we're offering a weekly meditation program that I think is really special. And, you know, you don't necessarily think of going to meditate at an art museum, although it can be a meditative experience.
I think right? So. Yes, yes.
So mindfulness meditation is a weekly program that we offer on Wednesdays at 1. It's meant to fit into a lunch hour. It's 45 minutes. And we select a different theme for each month. So this month, we're talking about listening. And in past months, we've talked about renewal or compassion or facing your fears. Mm-hmm. And we invite different guest teachers. We work with the wonderful Sharon Salzberg and some other amazing teachers to select an art object from our collection for each session. So if we're talking about listening, we might use the sculpture of Milarepa with his hand to his ear. And this is a deity and kind of a hilarious character who has a very colorful past, who ended up becoming a troubadour, a singer. And there's a beautiful statue of him in our current exhibition called The World is Sound, and where he is seated with his hand to his ear. And that is actually a traditional way that a singer would be featured, is with their hand to their ear in the Tibetan Buddhist lexicon, which is so interesting. Not with their mouth open singing.
Yeah.
So anyway, as people enter this last week's program, they saw an image of Milarepa up on the screen. They see detail of perhaps that hand to the ear, perhaps the lotus throne that he sits upon, perhaps his kind of curious expression on his face. And as they sit and they take in these kind of subtle and powerful images, they then begin our meditation program. And the way it begins is we'll contextualize a little bit. We'll say, this week we're talking about listening, and I'll explain the connection between the topic and Milarepa. And then our teacher will come up on stage and give a discussion about what listening means to us here in this room, in New York City, in this moment. how is this important to us?
Really?
Well,
yeah.
We need a little more listening in our lives these days, mm-hmm. right? There's a mm-hmm. lot of chatter, a lot of talking going on. And what does it mean to our meditation practice? And this is just a mindfulness meditation practice, secular offering. Well, it means getting quiet and listening to yourself. It means really coming to understand who you are and to listen to your mind. And really, meditation is gym for the brain, right? It's an exercise in self-compassion.
And rejuvenation.
Absolutely. So really taking this concept of listening, which comes from this object of Milarepa, and making it so personal that you will never see that statue again and not think.
And look at it in the same way that you did before.
Exactly. And it becomes powerful in a different way.
Moving to some of the other exhibits at the museum, which is really kind of interesting. I mean, yes, the Rubens collected a ton of Himalayan art, but my experience with the Ruben was when I went not too long ago and saw the Henri Cartier-Bresson exhibit of his photographs when he was in India. Now, are you involved in the determination of what is going to be at the museum? And if not, how does that impact what you do?
So my job really gets creative when that decision has already been made. So we have an incredible curatorial staff mm-hmm. who really works with objects in the physical spaces of the museum. And so Henri Cartier-Bresson exhibition, India in Full Frame, is an example of that. But what I can tell you is that, like I said, we are a museum that is dedicated to exploring what it means to be human. And really doing that through the lens of art objects mm-hmm. and concepts from religions and cultures that exist within the Himalayan region. And so the Indian Full Frame exhibition is really a great example of that, I think.
And so it's all under kind of the same umbrella.
Absolutely. Mm. What mm-hmm. does it mean to be human? And when you are taking in a Cartier-Bresson portrait that is so poignantly of the moment, and that's what he was really known for, was that capturing that moment,
right,
that essence. You know, it is an immediate kind of visceral experience of humanity through the eyes of another person. I think that is what is so powerful about his portraiture, you know, for example. And in terms of how that impacts what I do, you know, again, I think it's about not only exploring some of the kind of literal content that's involved there in the exhibition, but also thinking about these larger concepts and the universal components of them, of that. What is that moment all about? And do you capture the moment in your life? In how do you do it?
Mm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
sure, through photography like Cartier-Bresson, but how do you recognize a key moment in your life? And what do you do to mark it? And how do you see that in other people as well?
And what do you do to savor it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
What is the experience like for you when you go to other museums?
I don't know if I do experience it that differently than you, honestly, because I did come to this career through a circuitous route. And it's not necessarily where I imagined that I would end up, although I'm so grateful to be here. But I really try to maintain that perspective of the every person coming into a space. Where are the bathrooms? Am I comfortable here? Is there a chair
it's
for me to sit
so
in?
It's so crowded. I can't get to see the art.
Yes,
yeah, whining. Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just what's really, you know, what's really bringing me here today? I want to learn something about myself, I think. And I think through, you know, looking deeply at something that is beyond yourself, there's this kind of effect that reverberates and you get to look more deeply within as well. I mean, that's something that I think about and I really play with in my work. And I do think about it when I visit other museums as well. I guess that's something that's changed for me. But I think it's important to what I do mm-hmm. to try to maintain that perspective of the every person who's just, you know, coming to a museum once in a while, maybe making, you know, finding a home there in some way. But, you know, I think we have to be really thoughtful about creating kind of these portals of access for people that really can support who they are and what is going to make their day better.
Well, and in addition to getting us at a young age, you know, and drawing us in and exposing us. I mean, you know, this is a no-brainer. What goes first in school programs? You know, art and music, you know, they're
so
the ones,
true.
They're so dispensable.
I do think that it's a really different experience entering the Rubin Museum. It is a very intimate space. And I think it's a good fit for the Rubin because that artwork is all about the internal world and what that human experience is like. So I think it's a great fit for the Rubin. And I think people who come to the Rubin are often seeking that. Or they're seeking.
Mm.
They're seeking from a very kind of personal point of view. And I think that that environment is key to support that kind of experience. I mean, that doesn't mean that, you know, the grand sort of encyclopedic museum experience is less important or less valid. Isn't it great? There are all these different kinds of museum experiences that can be had.
For sure.
And that that the Rubin is really a unique place.
And it's a perfect match for you, isn't it?
I have really come to love it and to love that offering of kind of this creative tension between the intimate experience and then that sort of adventure part, you know? And I think, again, that is a little bit of the artist in me. I love that intimate connection with, you know, as a performer that you get with an audience. And I also love to push the edge of what's expected and really get people to push their own edge.
I think it's really great as I listen to you talking, and we basically run out of time, but how you have explained what it is you bring to your profession. How many performance artists and people in theater have the job that you have, head of programming at a museum, that this marriage makes such perfect sense? I never even entertained the idea. I did not expect to hear you say this, that you were in performance art as opposed to being a painter or studying, you know, museum acquisitions or whatever. I'd have made that up. You know what I'm saying?
But I do, yeah. And I think I'm really lucky. I stumbled into this kind of synchronous, you know, career for myself. And I do it within this, I just want to give a shout out to my amazing colleagues who I do this within this context of people who do have this background, who are, you know, who've made a career out of visual art and collections. And I get to really, you know, alongside them, focus on the people.
Would you say that the Rubin Museum is an anomaly in terms of what you do?
I do think it's a little bit special in that way. And, you know, that's kudos to the institution for really making space for that. I don't think all museums...
And thinking outside the box.
Absolutely. And I would say that the Rubin Museum really supports innovation. And that's exciting for me. That definitely supports creativity. And, you know, you can try something like the Dreamover and... you know, work things out a little bit. Get it.
There's
get
the
it
freedom
in shape.
To try something. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And
exactly.
Then you move on to something else.
And that, I do think, is a really great offering that the Rubin has. And I think it translates. It's not just an internal experience. It's something the visitor gets to experience, too. It is innovative in a lot of different ways. So I'm excited to just to be able to be a part of that and contribute to that.
Well, we are grateful to the Dawn Eshelmans and her creative team. And go to the Rubin Museum.
Please.
If you're in Manhattan, it is on 7th Avenue and 17th Street. And marvel at the gorgeous building that it is and the so impressive staircase as well as the great art that is housed there.
Thank you, Sandy.
I really enjoyed meeting you. And thanks so much for sharing all about your career and about the mission of the Rubin.
Great to meet you as well. Thanks.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.